Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Steve Rendell, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, as Karl Rove becomes the subject of intense media scrutiny, the White House is being raked over the coals by an angry and suddenly reanimated press corps. Why are they so agitated? Is it because they were lied to by the White House? Or perhaps because their colleague, Judy Miller, is in jail for refusing to divulge her sources, perhaps including Rove? FAIR editor Jim Narikas will join us in a discussion of the angry press and the limits of journalistic confidentiality. Also this week, the power of the pharmaceutical industry. The nation's leading drug manufacturers have considerable political clout, but how do they flex their muscles when it comes to the media? Trudy Lieberman of the Columbia Journalism Review has taken a look. She'll join us to talk about what she found. All that's coming up, but first we'll take a look back at the week's press.
Many pundits insisted that partisanship should play no part in the discussion of the July 7th terrorist attacks in London. But it seemed like business as usual in the right-wing media, as commentators used the attacks to score political points and promote their pet agendas. On Fox News Channel's special report, Jeff Birnbaum suggested we'd see an increase in support for the Iraq War. He explained that the attacks would change the views of Americans who, quote, didn't believe Bush's oft-repeated reminders from the stump that, in fact, we were in war and we had to act that way, close quote. Other pundits suggested that issues like abuses at Guantanamo Bay or global warming were now off the radar. And the Wall Street Journal's Daniel Henninger argued that the proper response to the London attacks was to confirm John Bolton as UN ambassador. Well, meanwhile, some were quick to criticize anyone who opposed Bush policies. MSNBC's Joe Scarborough lamented the fact that Hillary Clinton had the temerity to bring up the White House's record on domestic security spending. MSNBC's Chris Matthews a few days later called Clinton witchy for having done so. But if these pundits object so strenuously to partisanship and politicization, why were other commentators permitted to take the London bombings as an opportunity to boost Bush? Well, Fox's Bill O'Reilly turned his fire on the media instead, saying the Guardian newspaper, quote, might be edited by Osama bin Laden, close quote, and that the BBC wasn't serious about terrorism. Well, that was a problem throughout Europe, according to O'Reilly. As he put it, quote, what good does it do to Al-Qaeda to alienate Europe when Europe has basically been not on their side, but certainly putting the U.S. as the big villain, close quote. He almost sounds like he's saying they deserved a lesson. Further proof that when it comes to right-wing pundits, almost anything is acceptable.
The latest application of a double standard in reporting from the Middle East comes to us from USA Today's July 13th edition. In a report about a bloody suicide bombing in the town of Netanya that killed at least three Israelis and injured more than 30, USA Today reporter Matthew Gutman explains that the attack, quote, ended 5 months of relative calm in the region, close quote. Well, not exactly. The attack may have been the first deadly violence against Israelis in the five-month period, but according to the Red Crescent Society, the Red Cross-affiliated humanitarian aid group in the Middle East, at least 41 Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza have lost their lives over the same period, and injuries have numbered at least 135. On several previous occasions, we've pointed out how U.S. journalists have used the same relative calm language to describe periods that were quite deadly and violent for Palestinians. Since this kind of reporting discounts the suffering of Palestinians, it skews American views of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. But then maybe that's the point.
The July 7th Washington Post referred matter-of-factly to research purporting to show that George Bush got marginally better network news coverage during the first 100 days of his second term than he did during the first term. The Center for Media and Public Affairs, readers were told, found that 33% of comments about Bush on the networks were positive during that period, as against 29% last time around. Counterspin has talked before about the flawed methodology of this sort of soundbite study, which categorizes individual statements as either positive or negative. The most cursory investigation of such research turns up fundamental problems. For example, the group offers a statement of CBS's John Roberts that Bush took the country to war on quote-unquote flawed assumptions as an example of negative coverage. But isn't that statement true? And if it is it really negative Or is it just a statement of fact that happens to be bad for Bush? CMPA's research is marked by such problems. The group's infamous 1992 study of PBS reached its conclusion that the network was rife with left-wing bias by studying only documentary films and excluding regular programs by the likes of William F. Buckley and Morton Kondracki. Slippery research is bad enough, but leave it to Fox News to make it even slipperier. While CMPA takes pains to say that they only code comments as opposed to positive or negative stories, both Britt Hume and Bill O'Reilly made that leap in their remarks on the research, with Hume claiming the study showed the, quote, solid majority of stories on ABC, NBC, and CBS were negative, close quote.
The headline of the New York Times July 5th science section was blunt: Straight, Gay, or Lying? Bisexuality Revisited. The Times reported that an upcoming study casts doubt on whether true bisexuality exists, at least in men, and, quote, lends support to those who have long been skeptical that bisexuality is a distinct and stable sexual orientation, close quote. In suggesting that men who claim a bisexual sexual orientation are liars, the Times echoes the study's senior author, J. Michael Bailey, who seems eager to confuse the study's assumptions with its conclusions. Bailey, who acknowledged that bisexual behavior exists, argued that, quote, in men, there's no hint that true bisexual arousal exists, and that for men, arousal is orientation, close quote. The Times reporter himself seemed to identify with Bailey's argument, even using the phrase true bisexuality, which suggests that people with bisexual behavior and identity might still not qualify as true bisexuals. Well into the piece, some cautionary and critical viewpoints were included. None of those viewpoints, however, gave readers any hint of Bailey's controversial history. In 2001, Bailey co-authored an academic article that argued that if it became possible for parents to determine the sexual orientation of their fetus, quote, selecting for heterosexuality seems to be morally acceptable, close quote, adding that it, quote, may tangibly benefit parents, children, and their families, close quote. And more recently, Bailey came under fire for a 2003 book which, much like the bisexuality study, implied that transsexuals were lying about their gender identity. Many of the women Bailey profiled for the study filed complaints against him for not getting their consent to be studied. In other words, Bailey has a history of promoting sensationalistic theories that anger the communities he studies. A relevant bit of context Times readers should have known.
And finally, with all the talk about the looming fight over a Supreme Court nominee, much of the media attention recalls the bitter fight over Robert Bork's 1987 confirmation hearings. But some of that history is false. The conventional media wisdom would have you believe that Bork and his allies were caught off guard by a well-organized liberal opposition, and that no similar pro-Bork infrastructure even existed. The July 12th Washington Post reported that Bork holds special meaning for the right. He is, quote, the martyr to treacherous leftist politics, a living lesson in the importance of waging an all-out battle for a judicial nomination, close quote. The Post recalled that, quote, when President Ronald Reagan nominated Bork, liberals mounted a well-organized, well-financed campaign against him, and conservatives were slow and ineffective in responding, close quote. But flash back to the Post 1987 coverage, and you'll find plenty of reporting about pro-Bork activism. He received support from the Knights of Columbus, the Fraternal Order of Police, the National Federation of Republican Women, and the Southern Baptist Convention Public Affairs Committee. The Post also noted that letters to the Senate Judiciary Committee were running almost 3-1 in favor of Bork. Other outlets reported that heavy hitters like Jerry Falwell were in on the fight as well. This campaign to distort the past is being led by the very groups lining up to support whomever Bush nominates to the court. It's the job of reporters to set this record straight, something they're simply not doing yet.
Thanks, Peter. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch group FAIR. FAIR also publishes a magazine called Extra. I'll be giving subscription information for Extra later on in the show. Bush advisor Karl Rove has become the subject of an intense media focus since July 9th, when Newsweek magazine revealed Rove had spoken to Time magazine journalist Matthew Cooper about Valerie Wilson, also known as Valerie Plame. Wilson is the former undercover CIA agent who, it is alleged, was outed by someone close to the White House to punish her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, for contradicting pre-war White House claims about Iraqi weapons-related purchases. The Newsweek revelations would appear to put the lie to White House denials that Rove had talked to journalists about Valerie Wilson and seemed to have lighted a fire under a normally docile White House press corps. Joining Peter and I for a little roundtable discussion on all this is our FAIR colleague, Jim Narikas. Jim is the editor of FAIR publications, including our magazine, Extra. Welcome back to Counterspin, Jim.
That's good to be on.
Well, Jim, let's begin with the press corps. White House spokesman Scott McClellan has been under pretty heavy fire from journalists lately. Are we seeing some sort of a transformation? Why the change? Are journalists waking up to their professional responsibilities to hold the White House's feet to the fire?
Well, you know the expression, don't kick someone when they're down? The press corps always believes that that's the safest time to kick someone. People have been talking about this for weeks, but Karl Rove's name hadn't come up at the White House daily press briefings for weeks. And then suddenly the leak of the emails from Matthew Cooper to his editors that pretty much laid out that Rove had talked about Joseph Wilson's wife as being with the CIA, that did sort of open the floodgate. There's such a dramatic contradiction between Scott McClellan's absolute assurances that it was ridiculous to think that Karl Rove could have had anything to do with this. He couldn't have been more definitive about how innocent Karl Rove was of any involvement in this matter, and that certainly if they discovered anyone had been involved with this, they would be out of the administration. And then suddenly when evidence came out that, yes, Karl Rove had talked about Joseph Wilson's wife to at least one journalist, suddenly, even though they had been talking about this case all along, suddenly you couldn't talk about it because it was under investigation. And so any question related to Karl Rove was just stonewalled, and it was frustrating for the press corps to be faced with these so obvious lies and hypocrisy, and they just wouldn't address it anymore because it was no longer convenient for them to do so. It was kind of a red flag for them, I think.
But the level of the anger seems to be very intense. They seem more upset than they were about false White House WMD claims, which they bought hook, line, and sinker, and had a reason to be very resentful.
I think Judith Miller is part of this. Part of the club of the Washington Press Corps, they do have some kind of solidarity amongst themselves. And she's in jail because of the desire to know what was said to her. And as she's in jail basically protecting either Karl Rove or someone like Karl Rove himself is refusing to take any responsibility. You know, he's not coming clean with any of what's going on. And I think that they identify with Miller and have some resentment on the fact that Miller's in jail.
I think it is hard for those of us who don't sit in the briefing room to fathom the level of anger. Maybe comedians are capturing it better. Jon Stewart made a joke about replacing the White House press corps with real reporters, at least for a day. Harry Shearer, another comedian, suggested that journalists tolerate a certain kind of lie, a lie from the president, the White House, the vice president, anyone practically, except the White House press secretary. For some reason, that relationship is considered more sensitive, and somehow reporters don't respond to those kinds of lies as favorably. Does that make any sense, or are we sort of getting into the psychology of the press corps?
Somebody referred to John Bolton as being a kiss-up, kick-down kind of guy. And I think that describes a lot of people in the press corps. There is a kind of obsequious attitude sometimes towards people in power, people like Karl Rove, who are perceived as having a great deal of clout. The person who feeds the press corps on a daily basis, at least Scott McClellan, I don't think is seen in that kind of light. And so while you have to show a great deal of deference to the people with real power in the White House, Scott McClellan is someone that you can take your frustrations out on.
Well, the Republican National Committee has struck back. They have a set of talking points they're passing out. They're intended to discredit Joe Wilson, defend Karl Rove. So however things may have appeared to have changed in the press corps, at least for a day or two, some things remain the same. So now we're seeing plenty of ink and airtime devoted to rehashing some things that seem settled. Was Joe Wilson qualified to go on this trip? Was his wife really covert? Maybe the law doesn't say what we think it says. A lot of this stuff that's just intended to kind of muddy up the story and hopefully get people off.
It's reminiscent of the Swift boat veterans.
Sure.
This whole case is about the attempt to discredit Joseph Wilson. He had put out an op-ed that really did create a lot of political damage to the administration by really poking holes in the whole weapons of mass destruction hoax. And the standard Republican playbook is to smear the messenger so that you can safely ignore the message. When Cooper took that leak from Rove, he went out and wrote a story, pretty much the story that Rove wanted him to write, saying, well, what about this? What about that? What about this in regards to Joseph Wilson? Most of it completely irrelevant and a total distraction from the actual evidence that Joseph Wilson brought forward. But the press corps is so willing to go off on any scent that is put down by the Republican spinmeisters.
Well, as mentioned, one reason journalists are angry is that their New York Times colleague Judy Miller is in jail for refusing to divulge her sources, perhaps including Rove. So the debate about journalistic confidentiality continues. Jim, Fair has been critical of the view that reporter confidentiality ought to be something of a blanket right with next to no exceptions. Tell us what's wrong with that view.
Well, nobody is really arguing that there's an absolute right in every case to defend your sources. But in order to defend Judith Miller, you pretty much have to pretend that there is. You have to say that if in any case a journalist gives up their source, then that will have a terrible chilling effect on investigative journalism. The problem is that if you acknowledge that there are some cases where you would be ethically obliged to give up your source, it's hard to say why this is not one of those cases. This is one of the most terrible examples where you have a source who's lying, defaming political enemies. You know, it's a powerful person at the top of the political ladder, who could easily say anything in public without fear of retribution. Why is this a case where a person needs a protection of anonymity, aside from the fact that they might go to jail if you explain what they did?
It would seem that Judith Miller isn't protecting a whistleblower, but instead is protecting a member of the government, perhaps, who's using the awesome power of the government to attack a government critic. It doesn't seem to be a poster child case for confidentiality.
Yeah, unfortunately, this is the way that confidentiality is most often used in the press corps of today, is by people in power who want to get out their message without any kind of accountability. And that really is not something that the press corps ought to be rallying in defense of.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we have time for. We've been speaking with our Fair colleague, Jim Narikas, editor of Fair Publications. Thanks for joining us today on Counterspin, Jim.
Thanks for having me on.
The pharmaceutical industry certainly has enormous power, and the multi-billion-dollar drug business is not easy to cover for journalists. From scientists being paid to tout specific pills to aggressive PR and marketing efforts. And let's not forget that pharmaceutical companies are huge advertisers, especially on the network newscasts. Trudy Lieberman is a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review, and she's investigated this issue for the magazine's July-August issue. Trudy Lieberman, welcome back to Counterspin.
Thank you.
Now, your piece starts with this story of a deceptive marketing campaign for a sleeping pill. It's actually a story we talked about here on Counterspin recently. It does seem to serve as a perfect model for how this can all work, the PR strategy, the failure to disclose the sources of information, these paid scientific experts, and so on. So give us a quick summary of how Lunesta was sold to the public and to the press.
Lunesta is a pill, sleeping aid, that is being marketed by a company from Massachusetts by the name of Sepracor. And it came on the market, it got approval the end of last year, and is on the market now. And about the same time that Lunesta began to be advertised on television and in magazines, what we saw was a poll by the National Sleep Foundation, which is sponsored by the industry. Lots of drug companies contribute money to various activities of this organization. And the poll showed that Americans were not getting enough sleep. And the poll tended to reinforce the marketing activities of the drug maker in this case.
Now, you do suggest that there's a sort of fundamental problem with how stories like this are reported. We have reporting on drugs it's either a business story or a health story, but there's this undercovered angle that you're trying to get at in this story. Why can't reporters spend time on this beat?
Well, it's a complicated beat, and there's lots of political pressures all over the place for reporters who cover drugs, not only from their own organizations, which, as you noted in your intro, take a lot of money in ad revenue from drug companies, so there's almost like a built-in conflict of interest. But there are all kinds of groups that are out there trying to get reporters to write a story favorable to them. And certainly the drug companies, when they market a new drug or they launch a new drug, are doing it. Sometimes they do it directly and sometimes they do it indirectly. And then there are all kinds of other groups. Sometimes these groups are fronts for the drug companies, and they try to get reporters to write stories about treatments or drugs. And again, sometimes it's very subtle, sometimes it's very indirect. So it's all part of this great marketing web for pharmaceuticals that the drug companies have spun over many, many years.
Now, you mentioned this advertising factor. You actually counted up the advertising you see on the nightly newscasts. And when you do watch those newscasts, as millions of Americans do, you're bombarded by all manner of drug advertising. What kind of role does this play? Did you talk to anyone who suggested that this might be a factor in how they make editorial decisions?
The reporters I talked to were rather circumspect about that. Some of them did say that their editors often wanted the real positive news, or maybe the one shred of news that might be positive from a study, and they wanted that very high up in their story or high in their broadcast. And the risks of the drug or the harms, the drawbacks, came much later, if it came at all. And sometimes the reporter said that they knew that many of these studies were very nuanced, but that nuance did not fly very well with their editors, who, for whatever reason, are looking for a positive story that can give hope to the public.
You suggested that that's kind of built into the journalistic culture and perhaps even into our broader American culture as well, this willingness or this encouragement that perhaps this new drug will offer some hope to people. You think that just permeates the media coverage as well?
Absolutely. We like medicines. We like doctors. We like healthcare in this country, and we like a lot of it. And really, we believe that if we just take the next pill or we just take the next treatment, it's going to be a miracle cure. We're that's sort of ingrained almost in the American psyche, and then it really has been since the early days of antibiotics after World War II. And I think that most people believe that, and I think editors believe that, reporters believe that, and so you tend to want to believe that this study or that study is going to be the big breakthrough, and really most of them are not.
You spent some time in the story talking about Vioxx, and I wonder if that tale is somehow related, where you did have a few reporters who were sounding some cautious notes in the midst of relatively celebratory media coverage. And of course, in the end, that caution should have been heeded, I suppose.
Well, what we found was that the reporters basically, from the very early days of Vioxx and Celebrex, they were pretty much celebrating the virtues of these drugs. And it wasn't uncommon when both of them came out to talk about them as super aspirin in headlines or in their copy, and not really talk about any of the side effects or the harms that could come from these drugs. And as our timeline in the story notes, they certainly missed a lot of the clues that were there about the potential problems of COX-2 inhibitors.
Now, you do tell one story about a reporter who tried to perhaps push a little harder than most in one of these stories. CBS's Cheryl Atkinson. Explain what happened to her when she started asking questions.
Well, Cheryl had problems with drug companies as well as the FDA. Drug companies tried to influence her by providing spokespeople for her to talk to, and many of these spokespeople had financial ties to the drug maker. And when the drug companies and their PR people figured out that she might be writing something that they might not like, they were very eager to try to get her to talk to their sources. And so there's all kinds of emails that went back and forth between Cheryl and drug companies about who she should talk to for their stories. They tried very hard to get her to talk to certain people. And then at the FDA, when she noticed certain discrepancies between what the FDA was saying about some of the COX-2 drugs and what their own advisory panel had recommended, she tried to get to the bottom of this apparent discrepancy. She was acting like a good reporter. When you see something that doesn't make sense, you start asking questions about it. And in this particular example, which I talk about in my story, she says that the FDA just stonewalled her in the end and wouldn't answer her questions.
And it seemed like this was a retaliation for not particularly something she was writing or working on, but just the fact that she was asking the questions at all.
I think that might be right. I think that's how she saw it, that the FDA often plays favorites with reporters, and if you ask questions they don't want to answer, then they may not answer any questions.
Mm-hmm. Now, finally, you read a story like hers, and you realize that perhaps most reporters would give up at some point, that with all of this trouble from the industry groups, even from the regulatory agencies that are supposed to dispense this information, that the average reporter might say, or even editor might say, well, forget it, this is just too much trouble. Do you think that that might be a sort of a typical case, and Cheryl Atkinson's case is kind of atypical?
Probably. I think that's right. I think that a lot of reporters just give up, and sometimes it's very hard to buck their editors. And there's a tendency on the part of editors, I think, to say that if some drug's been approved by the FDA, it must be fine, so why are you questioning it? And it's that mindset. Again, that goes back to our love affair with medicines and all things that are health-related, that if the FDA has given its imprimatur to a drug, then why are you questioning it? What are your sources? What are you trying to do? So basically, that's what was going on here.
Mm-hmm. Well, we've been speaking with Trudy Lieberman. She's a contributing editor to the Columbia Journalism Review. Her story, Bitter Pill, is in CJR's July-August issue. You can read it online at www.cjr.org. Trudy Lieberman, thanks for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bimonthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That's 1-800-847-3993. Be sure to tell them that you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. If you missed part of today's show or would like to hear other Counterspin broadcasts, you can do that at FAIR's website at www.fair.org. This show was engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media and co-hosted by Peter Hart. I'm Steve Rendell. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.